from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. And so, all eyes today on Democratic Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. They have excruciatingly little time now to come up with a deal on the debt ceiling to avoid default and possibly reopen the government. Yesterday, the House failed to do it. The details of a Senate deal, the sticking points, the talking points, the face-saving and fine points, all in the balance today. And of course, it must still go back to the House. John Boehner and hardline Tea Party Republicans. The stakes are starkly sobering, frightening. This hour on Point, a day before the day we risk default. The deal-making and the pitfalls in Washington. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Can you believe this situation? What's the right way out now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us to start this hour, Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report, joining us today from Chicago. Amy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And Annie Lowry, economic policy reporter for The New York Times. Annie, terrific to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Amy, first to you. In process terms, before midnight tonight, what series of things needs to happen for a default to be avoided? And I hear somebody's phone buzzing there. Things are happening all day long today. We get it. Okay.
That's right. Trying to keep up with what the developments that seem to be happening every 5 seconds, right? Look, what needs to happen right now is we need to finally get some votes. Last night we were supposed to get a vote in the House on the Senate deal that had been put together with the Majority Leader Harry Reid and the Minority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell. Everything looked like it was moving smoothly until John Boehner brought the deal to his conference, which split into multiple factions. It was clear he couldn't get 217 votes. Now we are back almost to where we started, except that it's become clear that John Boehner has no choice now but to pass a Senate bill, a bill that will pass in a bipartisan manner in the Senate via he will pass that bill with Democrats as the majority, and he will need to get Republicans, of course, as well, but he will not pass it with a majority of his caucus. This is not unusual for John Boehner. The last fiscal crisis was also solved in the same manner, where you had majority of the votes came from Democrats. But for Boehner, who is really trying to cobble something together he can get his majority to agree to, it's clear that he's at the end of the rope.
So a Senate vote and on some kind of agreed deal, and then a House vote, and all that is the idea before midnight, and we're clear? Is that it, Amy?
I think at the end of the day, we will have a deal. And it will be voted upon, and it's going to be at the last minute, but we will end up with kind of where we started this, with a short-term extension of the debt ceiling, a short-term extension on the budget for the House – I'm sorry, for government, and we will be back. Unfortunately, Tom, we're going to be back here again.
That is almost impossible to bear. Annie Lowry, New York Times, I hear you demurring there on when we may actually be out of the woods here. What do you see, Annie?
Well, there's some procedural hurdles that mean that the vote could not come down today before midnight. I think that might actually be likely.
Are you talking in the Senate, filibustering there? Ted Cruz jumps in and gives another 1,000-hour speech? Or what do you mean?
It looks like he won't be able to do that, but there's just some time that needs to elapse and some volleying that needs to go back and forth. So I think it's probably likely that they're going to get this done in a pretty timely fashion. And there's actually been a procedural effort to make sure that nobody can filibuster, because that could really, really put a damper on things.
Mm-hmm.
But as Amy pointed out, these extensions aren't very long. They're going to be doing this again in January, probably. And to a certain extent, the same problems are going to be with us. this while this Congress is still in session. There's still going to be this part of the House, part of the Republican caucus, that really doesn't want to, you know, go along with any of this. So I think that one thing from the Republicans' perspective that's good is that they're locking in the cuts known as sequestration for a longer time. But I think that that could be the next big fight, is over the level of government spending, which weirdly enough has not been a big part of this fight. It's been a budget fight that really hasn't been about the budget.
But of course, even if it's short extensions, that can feel like a relief when there's been a gun to the head and this fear of economic catastrophe has been a word used as of tonight. I mean, that remains a real threat, I assume, Annie, if the world markets don't see something coming together today. What are we looking at?
I think that the markets will be placated as long as they think that the deal is imminent. I don't think that they'll be bothered by some time spent on procedural work. And it doesn't seem that even though the Treasury is going to exhaust its extraordinary measures, it's only going to be left with cash on hand, it's probably going to make it for a couple more days before you would get into a situation where a default. And that's not something that you really want to mess with. It's far from an ideal situation. Treasury normally keeps a much bigger cash buffer on hand, and it's also issuing new debt. It's doing neither of those things at the moment. It has this very thin buffer. But there's a sense in the markets that things would probably be okay if Treasury wasn't back to doing its normal stuff by you know, over the weekend, I guess.
Amy, we had the conference yesterday down in the basement of Capitol Hill. John Boehner and his party caucus, sang Amazing Grace down there at the beginning, we read here, but that did not lead to a really sweet solution. A heckling of more mainstream Republicans, of Tea Partiers there, defiance from Tea Party Republicans. Is he prepared today to roll over the Tea Party caucus that has been so influential in bringing us to this point, Amy?
Well, he has no choice. And the reality is he's done it now a number of times. As I said, the last time we hit this fiscal cliff in 2011, that was a vote where the Tea Party was not with him. He had to go and get Democrats. Sandy aid for the hurricane victims. He had to go and get Democratic votes. Violence Against Women Act. He had to go get Democratic votes. He couldn't count on his own.
Isn't this different?
Caucus.
I've never seen the Tea Party fervor and willingness to even to, you know, take the barrel over the falls that we've seen this time, Amy.
No, it is remarkable. And what you're seeing is there's been a marriage of convenience between the Republican Party and the Tea Party for the last couple of years. And right now, that marriage is really on the rocks, and there's some counseling that is needed. And what happened last night, and again, this is not surprising when you see that, you know, there's a disunity with one part of the party, is that the factions divided not just between the Tea Party and the rest of the caucus, but there were other members who didn't like other certain parts of the deal. So it wasn't just simply the Tea Party saying, yep, absolutely not, we have to go about Obamacare. They didn't like other elements of a deal that the Senate had been talking about, or that Boehner and Republican leadership had been talking about. So this is really a party now that is so incredibly divided, and there's no way to bring it back. The best news if you're John Boehner is the fact that nobody else seems to want that job. So there's a lot of talk about, boy, if he does this, he is going to be ousted. The Republicans are going to stage a coup. Who's going to replace him? That's really the question, and there's no obvious successor there. I also want to go back to one point that Annie brought up, because I think this is really critical. The fact of the matter is Republicans had a victory in hand weeks ago. This was supposed to be a debate about the budget and spending. And in that debate, Republicans have won. There is, in this government funding legislation, the sequestration, right? The cuts,
yep,
to government
across
spending.
Across the board, broad acts.
Exactly. They are embedded in this, albeit short term, but in this budget agreement.
Of course, everything.
That is a victory for, yep, Republicans who say we want to cut government spending.
Yep.
Never did they start from that point and say, hey, guys, women, we have a victory here. We have gotten Democrats to agree to continue to fund the government at lower levels. That's a win. Now, let's take that win. Maybe we try to push our luck a little bit on Obamacare and other things, but we should at least declare victory here. They never did that. They went directly to Obamacare. So this has been a debate about Obamacare and about all kinds of other things. Never has it been about the one thing that it should have been about, and for Republican messaging purposes, they really wanted it to be about, which was about spending on the government.
Of course, it's hard to put Obamacare off the table now, and they certainly weren't ready to do that yesterday. We'll see what happens today. An unbelievable amount in the balance here right now. Annie Lowrey, of course, saying that, look, as soon as the clock ticks over on this crisis, we're into another round of negotiation. Who knows what happens there? Annie Lowrey, Emmy Walter, please stand by with us right now from Washington. Robert Costa, Washington editor at the National Review. New Republic just called him the most important reporter in the country over the past few weeks. Bob Costa, thanks very much for joining us. I see you tweeting here in the last few minutes. Senate sources saying John Boehner has agreed to take up the Senate's plan and allow it to pass with Democrats' votes. Of course, that's not over till it's over, Bob.
That's right, and I apologize for being a little late, but there's a lot of moving parts right now. But from what I'm hearing from my sources in both the Senate and the House is that Boehner has privately agreed to take up the Senate's deal, and that's big news because that means Boehner's willing to bring something to the floor that may need Democratic votes to pass.
So you're saying John Boehner has articulated or sent word to Mitch McConnell and the Senate leadership, give it to me, I'll take it to a vote here in the House, a bipartisan vote?
Yes.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Washington down to the wire on default with Amy Walter of Cook Political Report, Annie Lowrey, economic policy reporter for the New York Times, and Washington editor at the National Review, Robert Costa. Still yesterday, plenty of Tea Party people saying, no deal to John Boehner. Here was a Kansas rep. Republican Tim Huelskamp saying he would stand on principle and still work to defund Obamacare. You'll hear him, then CBS's Chip Reed, then Huelskamp again.
What is most interesting is hearing from folks who are furloughed right now, and they're saying, well, Congressman, keep fighting.
So even your constituents who have been furloughed want you to keep the government shut down in order to fight Obamacare.
They understand there's a higher principle here.
Higher principle. But even within the GOP, people saying this is lunacy. Here's Republican California Devin Nunes yesterday on CNN criticizing fellow GOP House members for keeping the government closed on the issue.
When you go out and tell your constituents that we are going to just shut the government down until we get rid of Obamacare, it's just lunacy, plain and simple.
Lunacy, plain and simple. So, Robert Costa, what are you hearing? What's the shape of the package that John Boehner, you're telling us, says he will bring to a cross-the-aisle vote in the House? What's it look like?
It looks like Speaker Boehner has accepted the political reality that the Senate's moving forward with the deal, and he has very few options left on the table. And so he's just privately agreed to accept the Senate deal. He may not cheer for it, but it may end up just coming to the House floor and passing with Democratic votes. That's already in the works. That's what staffers are working on now, the minutiae, the process details of how to move that kind of legislation through today and early tomorrow.
How many Republican votes does it look like he might bring to that vote across the aisle?
Probably around 50 to 100, maybe more. It depends on how many votes it gets in the Senate. If it gets 70 votes in the Senate, I'd say maybe 50 to 100. If it gets 80 votes in the Senate and it's a true bipartisan package, you could see 100 to 125, 130 Republicans in the House back
it. Yesterday, he said he could not do it. It all fell apart. What's changed? Or is it just the clock, just the deadline, Robert?
What happened yesterday is the House couldn't pass its own plan. So it was a bucket of cold water on the House's face. They realized that they couldn't even pass a conservative plan. And so if they can't pass their own plan, the leadership met last night and they said, if we can't pass our own plan, we have to just accept what comes out of the Senate. The legislation may officially pass out of the House first because of the way the legislation is set up. It has to be an amendment to the Senate bill that goes back to the Senate. But it's going to be the Senate deal. It's McConnell and Reid more than anyone who are shaping this final contours of the package.
Annie Lowrey, look at the U.S. Senate for us with us a minute today. What kind of a vote do you see there? How big? Do you see something coming in big enough that it might bring in more fulsome Republican participation in the House, Annie?
I think so. We've heard some more moderate Senate Republicans say that they would vote for this package in order to have the budget fight that they want to have at a later time, right? But that they don't want to play with the debt ceiling. They want to get people back to work. And that I think that there's a real sense of fatigue. This has not been a fun process for anybody. So I agree with Robert. I think that you could see a pretty big Senate vote on this package, despite the fact that I don't think that this is anybody's ideal. You know, this is not a solution that anybody is really happy with. It's hard to say whose victory it is because because it's been so exhausting and terrible for both parties. But I think that it should have no trouble getting out of the Senate. That's clear. And if Speaker Boehner brings it forward, it should have no trouble getting out of the House either.
The Speaker asked yesterday, again, this is Kelly O'Donnell, NBC, whether there'd be a deal, whether he would flirt with default. Here's the reporter and the Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, can you guarantee to the American people Congress will not go past the deadline and push us into default?
Listen, I have made clear for months and months that the idea of default is wrong, and we shouldn't get anywhere close to it.
But we are close to it, and the language was bitter yesterday from Senate Majority Leader on the Senate floor attacking House Speaker John Boehner.
I'm very disappointed with John Boehner, who would once again try to preserve his role at the expense of the country.
To hang on to the speakership, Bob Costa, what about that bitterness? Who's Boehner dealing with here? Is it just Mitch McConnell? Mitch McConnell, the go-between with Harry Reid, or is it all one big kumbaya now?
Not really a kumbaya. The House is divided right now. Republicans are infighting. But McConnell, his whole goal with working with Reid is to try to protect sequestration cuts from the 2011 Budget Control Act. And he was worried Reid would get aggressive, and Reid actually started talking about fixing some of those sequester cuts over the past week. And so McConnell's in defense mode right now. He's just trying to protect the status quo, get past this mess.
And what about the hardline caucus in the House? Are they going to be persuaded? Amy Walter says, look, there's a Republican victory here. Maybe Mitch McConnell will pick up that message. But their message, not to mention Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, has been, we have to take down Obamacare. Can they be? Will they be mollified with a protect sequestration battle cry, Bob?
They're not going to be happy with this deal, and I expect at least 40 to 50 of them to be outwardly opposed to it. But at this time, with the clock ticking, Boehner has done everything possible politically to work with that group on the right. He has followed their defund strategy for months. He has gone through a series of votes that are very conservative in nature, trying to shape the debate, and it has yielded very little. And so the situation that Boehner's in now is, of course, he risks alienating that right flank, but at this point, if he does not accept the Senate deal, which he will accept it according to his allies, he would just be blamed for default, and he thinks that would cost them the majority perhaps in 2014. So he's trying to be pragmatic within the internal Republican dynamics in this conference.
Amy Walter points out they've done it before. Of course, you do it again, you start to make precedents. Let's hear from our listeners. Manville, Louisiana. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling because I'm concerned. I work for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and we do two basic things. We do lease sales, which is the largest single source of non-tax-based income for the United States economy, and we do oil and gas permitting. Oil and gas permitting offshore has already been shut down, and a lot of people don't realize how many contractors, in addition to the federal employees, are about to be furloughed. Because once we get into a situation of default, without anybody there to do the oil and gas review or prepare for these lease sales, they're literally going to have to shut in Gulf of Mexico domestic energy production, which is the largest source of domestic energy in this country.
Scott, I appreciate your call. There's another reality check right out from the field, the flow of energy also on the line, not to mention the sort of financial flow of this country and the world. I appreciate it. Reality checks are always good on this. One more right here. Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to respond to one of your guests who said it's hard to see who got a victory out of this. And I did. The American people got a victory out of this.
How so?
This is a good day.
Why?
Because for weeks, Mitch McConnell, the Wall Street Journal, Senator Judd Gregg have all said that the House Republicans have taken a hostage that they are not willing to shoot. And President Obama called their bluff. And today you're going to see Boehner prove that, in fact, they aren't willing to shoot the hostage. And what that means is not just that we're going to get the debt ceiling raised for tomorrow, but any future attempt to hold the debt ceiling hostage will not be credible. And that's a good thing.
Mark, we've got it. Robert Costa, we just have you for another minute. What about that? New precedent here. They may take a hostage, but they won't shoot it. Bluff called. We won't be back here again.
The right needs to find a way to get conservative policy through. And it seems like these fiscal standoffs have not been a great way to do that. So there's going to be a lot of rethinking, I think, over the next few weeks and months about how exactly in divided government can conservatives get anything done?
What about getting a majority in both houses of Congress? Isn't that the traditional way that's done?
Traditionally it is, but as the party moves more to the right, they don't seem to be trying too hard to be winning a lot of these purple seats in purple states. So it's a difficult situation because they want more conservative policy, not more centrist policy that can maybe win some independents.
I mean, it sounds like you have to move away from majority rule to make that happen.
Who knows at this point? But as long as the House is dysfunctional and they can't really pass much, and Senate Republicans are dealing with poor candidates across the country who aren't able to win general elections, it's going to be pretty much more of the same.
Fasten your seatbelts, fellow Americans. We may be working out today. Bob Costa says John Boehner is agreeing to put a vote before the full House on what the Senate produces. We'll be watching. Bob Costa with the National Review, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Steve in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Tom, I'll take the Tea Party position for three reasons.
Okay.
One, I don't think borrowing money to pay your bills is any way to run a country, much less a business. Two, the administration said that the sequester was unthinkable, and it turned out to be a tempest in a teapot. And three, when President Obama was a candidate, he criticized the American government and the American people for living beyond their means. He said he was going to be a pay-as-you-go president. And then it seems the first thing he did was to institute Obamacare when we can't even pay for Social Security and Medicare. So he seems to be going on a borrow-your-way-to-prosperity type of mode.
I mean, he would be one in a long line of presidents on that front, Steve. But let me just ask you on your first point, don't borrow to pay your bills. Is it better not to pay your bills?
Well, Tom, something has to be done at some point. The obvious problem here is that we're spending too much money, and at some point we're going to have to bite the bullet. Either we're going to bite the bullet now, or we're going to have to become Greece.
I take your point, but the Tea Party emphasis has been all about Obamacare during this crisis. Was that a mistake, Steve?
Tom, that's because we can't pay Social Security, we can't pay Medicare. They're taking 50% of the gross national product, or how much it's worth. And when we can't pay for those, how can you start on another gigantic entitlement program that's even bigger than the others, too?
Steve, thanks for your call. Annie Lowry, where's the realism here? Steve says he's making a Tea Party argument, you know, for realism. Where's the realism here, Annie?
Well, one thing that I think is really important to note is that the deficit is falling really quickly.
Good.
It's coming down very, very fast.
Why?
You know, a couple years ago, we had these trillion-dollar deficits, and they're shrinking. That's because of a couple things. So one is that the economy has turned around. The second is that there's been a lot of cutting done in Washington.
Yep.
And then there's some kind of one-time factors, you know, about Fannie and Freddie and some other things. You wouldn't want to balance the government's budget really quickly when the economy is so weak. Unemployment is really high. A lot of Americans are having trouble finding work. There's no wage growth. And so economists across the spectrum, including Republican economists, think that when the economy is weak, it's important for the government to be spending beyond its means. It's important for the government to be running deficits. And some liberal economists even think that it's bad that the deficit is falling as fast as it has. And I think that actually the administration would prefer a bigger deficit at this point. So, you know, I think that there's probably an argument that when the economy is strong, you don't want a lot of government spending to crowd out the private sector. But the economy isn't really strong right now. And I'd also note that, you know, households in the government are different. The government has its own currency that it can control. So it's not a perfect analog. But certainly, I think that there's a faction in Congress and a lot of Americans who feel like the government should be balancing its budget all the time like the states do. But I'm not sure that economists are on the same page.
Let's go to New Orleans. Mindy is calling. Mindy, you're on the air.
Hey, Don. I have a couple of points. First of all, the deficit was created by a 12-year war, which nobody seems to talk about.
You're talking Iraq, Afghanistan, and everything that's been going.
The whole shebang.
Okay.
You go back to 2009 to now.
What about the crisis we're in now, Mindy? How do you see it playing out, sorting out?
Okay, I think Obama is brilliant strategically, and I think Boehner is going to prove to be strategically brilliant, too, because he's brought these Tea Party conservatives out to show really what you're dealing with, and they're nothing but, I hate to say this, Klansmen in suits. They do not like the president for obvious reasons. This is nothing about health care.
Klansmen in suits, that's pretty tough language, Mindy, but we've got your call. Amy Walter, there were stars and bars, Confederate flags out in front of the White House just in the last few days here. Emotions have gotten very high. Even that odd kind of symbol of resistance on a national budget issue. What about Mindy's analysis here that the president comes out a winner, and John Boehner does too? I guess the idea there that maybe this puts some of the Tea Party power back in the closet.
The sort of shaming of the Tea Party,
yeah,
as it were. Here's I think the point that both callers have raised, though, is important, and that is about how did we get here in the first place. And the reality is, you know, when we talk about our deficit, the war, the spending, they all contribute to it, no doubt. But we know what the real driver of this is, of the debt is and the deficit, and that's and our future problems, and that's our entitlement spending. It's Medicare, it is Social Security, it's Medicaid, it's all of those programs. And we also know that the previous years, the president and the House, of course, John Boehner and others have tried to sit down, craft a grand bargain, deal with these problems. That fell apart in the summer of 2011. It was revived somewhat right after the president was reelected, where he came and sat down with Republican senators.
But we're not really talking about those things.
The problem. We're not talking about those things. So this is my point that, you know, we can talk about sequestration, we can talk about the war, we can talk about all of those things that are driving our spending. But the reality is, if we're going to really get our fiscal house in order, if we're going to stop having these, it seems, almost daily fights about lifting a debt ceiling and our budget problems, we're going to have to tackle those issues. And the reality is, neither side wants to give. Republicans do not want to give on taxes in any way, shape, or form, and Democrats will not give in any way, shape, or form on entitlements. And so we're at a stalemate, and we are going to go crisis to crisis. This is the government we have now, month by month, crisis to crisis. And at this point, it looks like there's nothing stopping that.
This does not seem okay to me, to stay in the mode we've been in for the last couple of weeks, Annie Lowry. I mean, can you realistically sustain status as a world leader, global currency, economic superpower, you know, going from crisis to crisis month after month after month after month, Annie?
Well, we've been doing it for a couple of years now. I think everybody agrees it's not ideal. But I think that there's a lot of hope that eventually the fever might break in the next Congress.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Washington down to the wire on default with Annie Lowry, economic policy reporter for The New York Times, Amy Walter, national editor of the Cook Political Report. Even this morning, you've got Tea Party Republican Steve King of Iowa here saying, don't worry about a default. Not a big deal. The U.S. won't default. Here's King.
I'm not worried about this thing that they term default, because we are going to service our debt. We're going to pay the interest first, and we'll roll the principal over. It takes 8% of our revenue stream on average in order to pay the interest on our debt.
Yeah, well, not everybody's on board with that. Maybe they will avoid it. On the House floor this morning, Democratic Congressman, this is John Garamendi of California, pleading for a resolution to the standoff.
This is the House of Representatives. 435 of us elected to represent the people of America, to do right by them, to do right by this nation's economy, by the working men and women, even those that are laid off because of the shutdown, they want to work. It's time for us to end this. It's time for us to go to work on the long-term problems.
Maybe that will happen. Maybe. There's all kinds of word of movement here. Amy, Annie, please stand by. Ryan Grimm joins us right now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Ryan Grimm, thank you very much for joining. What's the latest you're hearing? I mean, I'm reading tweets here saying, game over, we've got a deal underway. What are you hearing, Ryan?
We're hearing that what we always expected would happen, which is that John Boehner would put something through the House with a combination of Democrats and quasi-moderate Republicans, is in fact going to happen. We just kind of spent the last month dancing around that issue and with the Tea Party trying to figure out every which way that they could to try to pull something else off differently. But it's not going to happen. The only question that remains is where precisely this bill will have to originate. There are procedural reasons that it may have to originate in the House of Representatives because that would prevent Ted Cruz and Mike Lee from filibustering it to death over in the Senate. If it started in the Senate, they could take us into default just by sheer obstruction, just with one or two senators. So
Cruz and Lee, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right, it'll start in the House, come to the Senate, and then we're done, and we can all move on with our lives.
Now, the fine points here on sequestration goes on in this deal, but there's a budget negotiation framework in this deal. Is John Boehner going to run with that as well, that will offer recommendations? You all have been reporting just in the last few minutes to deal with sequestration and a whole bigger agenda by December 13th. What's that look like, Ryan?
Yes, so this will include instructions that there will be a budget conference so that the Senate and House will meet to discuss the differences and report something back December 15th. The great irony here is that the Republicans held up this entire thing saying that they were demanding negotiations. Why won't the president negotiate? Why won't Democrats negotiate? Yet at the same time, since the spring, they have been resisting sending House members to a budget conference. And that was the last sticking point. Democrats wanted a conference, which is just a bicameral negotiation.
Why have the Republicans not wanted to get into this conversation about the very reforms, entitlement, and all the rest that everybody understands at some level we need?
Two reasons, a broad one and a specific one. The broad one is that the conversation doesn't work well for them, because when you start comparing the details of Social Security cuts, Medicare cuts, Medicaid cuts, et cetera, to revenue, the country's not on their side. The country would much rather protect Social Security, Medicare, et cetera. So they don't win the broad argument. Specifically, they would have to bring the Ryan budget with them to conference, because that's what the House has passed. And the Ryan budget, as both sides acknowledge, is more of a philosophical document rather than something that can actually be implemented into law. So you have the Democratic budget, which is based on prior budgets, so we know that it is a workable product. And the Ryan budget, which Ryan has always said is more of kind of a dream, a philosophical thing, somewhere they'd like to get, way off in the future. And so, not only do they have trouble winning the argument in public, but behind the scenes, when they start writing it, it just doesn't work.
So the concrete elements of this package that people are saying is now going to come out of the House, Senate will pass it, House will pass it, game over, we're dodging the default. If that should happen, government shutdown. What happens with that under this package, Ryan?
So that's over. It's and it will not come up before Christmas, or is it, call it a Festivus miracle. It won't be until January 15th until we'll have another one of these manufactured crises. And the debt ceiling is pushed off until February 7th, but there will be some extraordinary measures that the Treasury could take that actually pushes that into spring. The government will continue at its current sequester funding levels, though.
And this whole dynamic we've been locked in these last sweaty days here. I mean, they're supposed to wrap this up by December 13th. That's just why won't this just turn into another down to the wire nail biter that takes us to government shutdown again January 15th and to threat of default in February or sometime later in the spring? Why won't that just happen again, Ryan?
Well, that is precisely what will happen. Because
not if they wrap up a negotiation by December 13th, but what confidence should we have they'll do that?
They will not do it. And the main reason that they won't do it is that the American people do not want it. What, you know, it's called a grand bargain here in Washington, but what it really is it's saying, okay, we had a decade of tax cuts, a decade of wars, and now in order to pay that back, we're going to cut Social Security and cut Medicare and cut other social spending. That's most people outside of Washington don't see that as a bargain at all. They see that as a ripoff, and it doesn't work. And so that's why both parties want to set up these elaborate triggering mechanisms to try to force themselves to make some policy change that the American people don't actually want to see happen. And so because it will be done out in public over the next several weeks, it will fail because nobody wants to support these extremely unpopular policies. And we will be right back to where we are today in January, facing another government shutdown. The only hope for the government at that point is that it's closer to the election. And so Republicans might be less willing to go through another one of these debacles, lest they not just lose their speaker, but lose their house.
I don't know if I can take this. I don't know if the country really wants. I mean, maybe we should just have one big grown-up conversation here. Lowry, do you buy that analysis here that something needs to be done that the country doesn't want, so we're going through this kind of kabuki theater of high drama, real danger to create, you know, the dramatic situation in which these parties can do the unpopular?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Ryan's analysis is basically spot on in the sense that the reason that we haven't gotten a grand bargain, even though they've been negotiating over one for years now, is that everybody needs to hold their nose and vote. And nobody's going to like it. It's going to be tough. Seniors don't want to see their Social Security cut. But the idea would be that you would be making a long-term deal, that would be better. I don't really see a way that they're going to be able to pass anything other than continuing resolutions for the foreseeable future. I really honestly don't. And there's a lot of budget pieces on the table that they could play with. For instance, the Obama administration has said that they would accept something called chained CPI, which is a way of cutting Social Security benefits.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that Republicans really want. But again, it's just getting that whole package together. And again, it's worth stressing what we were talking about before. If we keep on getting continuing resolutions at sequestration levels, those are a lot closer to the Ryan budget than they are to President Obama's budget. That's going to be a big, big defeat for Democrats. And it's interesting to me that Republicans haven't really seen that as being a policy victory for them. And I think that you might actually, in time, start to hear them talk more about that because they do want those cuts in place. And they, in some cases, would like to make them deeper. I think that they'll also be willing to trade them dollar for dollar for cuts elsewhere in the budget. And so you might see that happening.
Interesting. I mean, they won't be able, I guess, to talk as much about Obamacare if there's a deal here right now. Peggy in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Peggy, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to say that the American people are so disgusted with this shutdown and debt ceiling strategy that the Republicans have been putting forward lately. I would like to call on the media to ask all congressmen and congressional candidates in the future to sign a pledge, since pledges are so popular, to say that they would never, ever shut down the government again or play with this debt ceiling. And if they decline to pledge that, they're not getting my vote, and they won't get the vote of a lot of Americans if this sort of pledge data was out there.
Peggy, I hear you loud and clear, but you know that a bunch of these congresspeople have voters at their back who want the opposite. I mean, in some of these very deep red districts, you know, they're saying, don't you dare stand down here.
Well, so be it. Those districts can have their people, but you can't have people like the Speaker of the House and other, you know, statewide office holders in the Senate playing these games. The vast majority of people in every one of those states does not want this going on.
Peggy, we've got it. But listen here for a second. This is Steve King again, real hardliner out of Iowa on CNN's Crossfire, saying that those who stand down on the debts, on the default and the government shutdown, those who don't stick with it will be, he says, they will be judged harshly. Here's Steve King.
At what point, then, do we look back in history and say, those guys and gals failed us? They should have held the line. They should have been willing to face the president shutting the government down, and they should have made an issue about the debt ceiling so that we could reform entitlement.
Yep, there's Steve King just yesterday. Peggy, thanks for your call. Bob in Bloomington, Indiana. Bob, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
It seems to me that in the private sector, if companies acted like Congress was doing right now, we'd have a chance to file a class action lawsuit, like with Big Tobacco. You know, they knew they were doing something that was going to hurt a lot of people. They did it anyways. And that's how it feels now. So other than voting at the ballot box, what is our form of redress for this? I mean, it seems to have gone beyond just voting people out that we don't like, but they're actually doing things to damage us. I mean, they're damaging our credit rating. They're damaging our reputation.
Bob, we hear that loud and clear, and many share that feeling. I do. Ryan, you can hear voters, you know, dissatisfied with the voting calendar here. They don't get to, you know, get in there often enough to discipline this Congress. Bob's looking out of Bloomington, Indiana, for some way to crack the whip without waiting for the next voting cycle.
I mean, I think Bob's best bet is to do something about gerrymandering. You have, and this goes back to Peggy's point, too, because not only will members of Congress running in these districts not sign a pledge that they won't shut down the government, in fact, scores of them have signed a pledge that they will never, ever, ever raise the debt ceiling under any conditions, no matter what. And so that means you start with this base of opposition that is trying to push, that has declared openly that it will push the country into default. And it, you know, if they do vote to raise the debt ceiling, they will get a primary, and that's all because of the way that gerrymandering has packed so many far right and far left voters into particular districts. I think you're going to have this this system of government, and you're going to have this gridlock until something is done about that process. Maybe you have a nonpartisan board draw the districts in each state. Maybe you need an actual constitutional convention that gets together and fixes this system, because until you do that, you're going to have the incentives that created the blow up that we just had.
So here we are on quite a day, and we're told now, headlines coming in even as we speak here, the House will vote first on the Senate plan, look for Republicans and Democrats to push that through. Senate leaders saying they're standing ready then to push it on through, and if all that happens, default avoided. Amy Walter, what lessons do you take away from this unbelievable chapter? We may plunge into another one, but let's just take lessons right here.
Right. The reality is we now are a country that is run not by the majority, but by the minority.
Well, and is that true as of today? I mean, after if, all, if Obamacare passes, was not defunded.
This is true, but to your point of that we actually got to this point, we got here because of the views of a minority, even within the out party, right? This was not a popular thing, even among Republicans.
Wag
so
the
it's
dog.
Clear that the minority is running it. To Ryan's point, though, about redistricting, I think that's important. The other thing to remember, and this is to the frustrated voters out there, so many of these members of Congress, they do sit in safe seats. Absolutely. The only way to make your point as a voter about your frustration is to show up in primaries. People don't vote in primaries. There's maybe 20-30% turnout. That is where now we have to get people to start focusing. November, by then, it's too late. The primary is the new general election.
You know, here on Facebook, Ron says to us, Andy Lowry says, this is insane. The best solution, put a clean resolution, clean debt ceiling lift on the table, and agree to sit down and talk about other measures we cannot function with hostage taking. Is that over, Annie, or are we going to plunge back into another round of that?
Well, the real mechanism for the government shutdown and the intransigence here, the real hostage was the debt ceiling. And Congress won't have to lift it again until about April. And I think that this might have proven that the Obama administration really, really wouldn't negotiate over it. They literally wouldn't talk to Republicans in some cases.
So now death, where is thy sting? Maybe it doesn't have the same power anymore. Maybe it's a dead bit of leverage.
certainly some Democrats are hoping that. And also with every day that goes by, we get closer to the election. And, you know, when I was talking with some Republicans yesterday, they were saying that part of the reason that they're finally just bringing this to the floor and passing it with Democratic votes is that they started to worry about their primaries. And as we get closer, there's going to be less willingness to shut the government down, I think.
Ryan Grimm, 20 seconds here. Hostage taking. Are we done with it if this all goes through today?
There'll be much less chance of happening in the spring because actually a lot of the primary deadlines will have passed. So these people will be guaranteed their re-elections. So we can do this all again next time.
What a fever. Maybe it's breaking today, but watch that space. Watch it all the way. Very grateful to the three of you for being with us this hour. Ryan Grimm, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Annie Lowrey, Economic Policy Reporter for the New York Times. In the thick of all this, you're very generous, Annie. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Amy Walter, National Editor at the Cook Political Report. You've got plenty to do, Amy. We'll let you go do it. Thank you for joining us here.
Thanks. I enjoyed it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.